school has to go off because of this darn meeting. Which I didn't know about either. I don't know. Nobody tells me things. Maybe I didn't listen when people tell me. Right, now, so what I'm going to suggest, what I want to talk about then, very quickly, is what the plan for the year is. Now, that thing that I've got down there, you do see what it says. That during the first year of study, the seminar discusses one or two works each week in order to gain general view of the field. And the following is only basic suggestion. It may be changed according to what we seem to need in relation to the lectures. That means that we won't do Melville in these seminars, because I'm going to lecture on him, just see what I mean. And if I lecture on things, I won't deal with them. I'm not sure about the Poe, so I'm going to risk that. I probably won't do the Mark Twain, because I did that last term. But I might have to do it for some of you who didn't hear those lectures. We'll see. Anyway, the idea, it's a rough thing. Now, you also see that it's planned so that the first term is basically short stories and essays. Do you see that? And poems. The only two long things are Thoreau's Walden, which I think if you haven't got time to read anything else, read the first section called Economy. And Huckleberry Finn is a full-length novel, but it's such a hell of a book that I feel no kind of compunction about the thing. It's just marvellous and a great book. And I lectured on it last term. I hope it like spurred some people to read it a little last year. So that's why. It's deliberately done so to get you into the thing as quickly as possible, because it's not going to take you much time each week to read those short stories and essays. You see, that was the idea. But then, of course, it's impossible to teach the thing with you on the basis of just those stories. So the second section does sort of like get a bit heftier. But it's not as heavy as it looks. Remind me, before we come to the Emily Dickinson, to give you the titles of the selected poems. I've chosen, I think, about a dozen. And her poems are terribly small. You know, they're only up to the longest one's about 15 lines or something like that. And they go from anything from 6 to 15. So they're kind of like short. And Red Badge of Courage is a very short novel. And not difficult in its form. An American Tragedy is enormous. Very, very long. a colossal amount of things. So the problem here is this. If you could possibly manage to read it in the vacation, I'd be glad. Or have a look at it. It's very long, but it's not boring, to my mind. And I'll try and indicate what it is about it before the vacation, so that you can read it with some kind of attitude. So I can tell you why I put it in. There's no choice about the Dreiser thing. I mean, if I chose Sister Carrie, it's long too. If I chose any of his major books, they're just long books, you see. And his short stories and plays just don't cover Dreiser, and that's that. So that's why. The two James things, as far as the Pornson is a novella, it's a very short novel, and The Beast in the Jungle short stories are right there. The O'Neill. Then that covers, you see, the what's called the naturalist period. I'll talk about it in a minute. Then the next two sessions are on drama. There's these two plays of O'Neill. The Hairy Ape's short, The Iceman Comes is rather long. And then the Clifford Odets play is just like ordinary like play length thing, and the other two. So they're easy to get in Penguin. You have to buy the Clifford Odets one. Buy two copies, because like that's my little book. It'll bring a little bit of money in, I hope. Mean Penguin, the farthing a copy. To buy two, because the farthing's not currency. You can even do that out, two, buy four. Great Gatsby's a short novel. Sounds right a bit longer, and so on. But those novels there are generally not very long. The Manhattan Transfer isn't very long. Arrowsmith is a bit. So that I've tried to put stuff in, generally speaking, that I think you can get to without an enormous amount of effort. I'm perfectly aware of the amount of work you have to do, and I think that there's a lot of hypocrisy in this department, talked about cutting it down. Who was it told me they had 13 lectures this term? God, Kiernan. Mr. Kiernan. That's ridiculous, isn't it? 13 hours of teaching? I mean, no student should have that. This is absurd. Oh, is there anything, sir? Dead dark. When are you supposed to read and write? Huh? Oh, I can see. It's just silly. So I really am aware of this, and I'm trying to do something about it. I hope, please note. So there it is. Right. Hi. Couldn't you manage it? What happened? I'm sorry. Can't you get the train?
Yeah, it's probably
better. Yeah. Can you, like, come sit down on the floor? I'm sorry there aren't any seats. As you see, this is a much bigger group than I thought. And I'm sorry about this. Next time we'll have to go into a bigger room. Because you see how nice and cosy it was in here. I mean, unless you want to sit around like this, does this suit you? How do you feel? Do you like this groveling on the floor?
Yeah.
It's difficult to take notes, is it? Yeah, don't take notes. But if you like this atmosphere, like sitting around in this kind of like cub meeting, or whatever. Well, I'll try. That's an idea. I never thought of that, of course. I like feel oppressed. That's what's the matter with me. How many more will I want? Right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Maybe a dozen more. I'll let you know on Monday in the lecture about that. We don't want any rituals and Buddhistic goings on, at least not just yet, the next term, a bit of time for that. Right, so the, you may smoke, what do you like? Bring your own ashtray. No, the thing is, I've decided about this. We have a room, in fact, you see. It's room one, in room 169 in the Strand, if we want to use it. But I've been using this room because it's nice and cozy. But I've never had this lump room of students before, you see, and that's the problem. So there it is. But I'll decide about that and let you know on Monday in the lecture. What I've been describing is the course. I didn't realize, I thought perhaps you couldn't make it. About me coming up to Bedford, by the way. You know, I said I might. My college says I may not go up unless I get paid. I know, but you see, everybody got one? You got one? Anybody else? No. So you see, I mean, I was going to do this like sneak in. See? No, I don't know what Kathleen Tillotson is going to say when she hears, you know, what you see. This is the point. So I've now got to write to her and like say, I'll come up to Bedford as there are 8 students, is it?
Yeah.
You're 7. Let's say once a fortnight, you know, for a little special session. But my college insists that I'm paid. Like that. Because they really are. I thought that I would just have to get permission. But they're very adamant about this. They say, no, you do not. You must get paid for this, otherwise you don't go. So there it is. I'm stuck with that one. you see. I'm sorry about that. I've got a feeling that Bedford might squawk. I just don't know. But I've got to find out. So I'll let you know. Okay, now what I was saying about this list is it's basically designed to cover as much as possible of the American field, but as you see, it's mostly stories and essays, and the idea is to cut down the amount that you have to read. I think that I'm cutting it down so that you don't even feel like that. There is such a minimum amount to read that you'll be able to do it, and you won't feel the compunction. The main problem is that in term two there is one very long novel, An American Tragedy, of Dreiser. It's unavoidable, I'm afraid. All his major stuff is long. If you could possibly read that in the Christmas vacation, I'd be glad. If not, it's just too bad. In the third term, which is as far as I've got when the big people arrive, again, it's stuck. Look Homeward, Angel is enormous, but all Thomas Wolfe's major work is, you know. I don't know what to do about that. I just can't. His short stories just don't cover the same kind of ground to me. So if you haven't got time to read these two big books, the Theodore Dreiser, American Tragedy, and this, try and read a great wadge of it, you know, and get the feel of the long sentences and the feel of why it's on such a big scale. You see, and then look up a book or another about it, which I'll come to those two in a minute. And the Faulkner the Bear is a a self-contained section in Go Down Moses, which is in the Penguin. Hart Crane's The Bridge is a long poem sequence, and Pound's Extra Pound. nice little misprint. Particularly, this is the man that said that poetry is news that stays news, do you remember? Okay. All right. complicated. So, Hugh Selmer Mobley is a poem singer. And then William Carr's William Selected Poems. Well, in actual fact, there wasn't any more put on the list, because what happens is, after that, is if we've got through a lot of that. You see, a lot of this, I'm going to lecture on Melville this term. The second term, I'd probably try and get into Hawthorne's novels and Poe's long thing, the novel called Arthur Gordon Pym, and some Whitman, because I want to talk about 1972 this year, if I can. So that a lot of this term one stuff will be cut out quite a bit, and then we can get on to the term two stuff in the term one. So I'm hoping at the end of this, at the end, when we've got through the list, we'll still have some weeks left, and then we can choose things that we want to do that are not in, particularly the contemporary poetry thing, after William Carlos Williams, if anybody wants to. There's a lot of people I've not put on, so that I'm hoping there'll be like an end gap that we can fill out. Now, those two books there by Robert Spiller and Marcus Cunliffe at the top, I think the only two books that you really need to look at as a general coverage. The Cycle of American Literature is American Paperback, Signet, I think it is, or Mentor, one of those. You know those? They're only about five bob or less, four and six, some of them. It's a very small book, very thin book. It's one of the few books I know that really does cover the range of American literature in a small compass intelligently. I think it's very good, that book. I recommend it. Marcus Cunliffe, he's professor of American literature, history rather. He used to be professor of American literature at Manchester. He's now professor of American history at Brighton, at the University of Suffolk. And that book, Literature of the United States, is a pelican. And it's a decent survey book, I think. And I think the two of them are okay. And you either get one of them or both. They're a bit different. The Marcus book's a bit longer and has a lot of opinions in it. Spiller's book is shorter and tends to be much more factual, doesn't risk so much. Different kinds of book. But they're useful little surveys, I think, particularly for your first go into all this. And that's the way, for instance, if you're doing the Thomas Wolfe, what in fact Robert Spiller says about Thomas Wolfe will help you to understand why Look Home at the End is a long book very quickly, you see. He only has about a couple of paragraphs, but you'll find it very useful. That's the way to handle it. Work at the thing. And what we'll do is to discuss each week these things slowly through. And gradually, at the end of the year, I hope that you'll have a view onto the whole field of American literature, which is understudied for the course, that is, from the early 19th century to the present day. Before that, of course, there is a big field of stuff, but we decided when we were to get this course going in this university that it would be unfair on students in the short time they have to expect to do 18th and 17th century American stuff as well. But let me just tell you that there is the 18th and 17th century material, which are extremely interesting, and you can already see the American quality of American literature developing very early. Now, one of the things I'd like you to think about, and having said this morning in my graduate seminar at the Institute that I don't know what American literature is anymore, I feel just a bit slimy about all this. But I really don't. It's very difficult, much more difficult than was banded around, to say just precisely what the American factor is. Now, I don't think there's a single one, but I would like, and I don't want to discuss this with you now, I would like towards the end of the year, for us to try and discover between us aspects that seem to be non-European. You see? I mean, do it empirically. Don't jump to conclusions, there's an American thing. Do you see what it is? I don't think there is a single factor which is American. I just don't think that anymore. I think a lot of stuff that's called American looks like Russian. I mean, people say, you know, like log cabins. Well, they had log cabins in Russia too. And so, no American wants to know this. You know, Lincoln might have been born, might have been raised in a log cabin, and the Russians have log cabins as well. That's kind of unpatriotic. So there's that out of the way. Then the space bit, you know, it's a huge country. Well, what about Siberia, you know, or Australia for that matter? Huge empty spaces in places called Alice Springs, which is like the equivalent of, I don't know, Dallas, what, Texas. No.
Does Australia have much resemblance?
Yeah, a bit.
What comparison do you know?
This is something that I've often thought some people ought to do, like the comparison. It's very, obviously the most difficult kind of study, like a comparative study about American, Australian, and Russian literature. And I mean, that's kind of like a mouthful, but somebody should do this in terms of land spaces, you know, reaction to space and time. And one of the cliches said about American literature is that, you know, that the climatic conditions, of the extreme climate thing. The space thing, you know, that's an enormous continent. So that an American in the southwest, extreme southwest, and an American in the extreme northeast are like different people, this kind of claim, and therefore the cultural difference will be there, and therefore they will write differently. This idea of regionalism within in American literature is one of the ways that American literature can be defined. I'm very skeptical. I've just written an introduction to a book that I've compiled on William Faulkner, who is a Southern American writer, you know, who writes about the South. And the more I thought about it, the more he seems to be writing continually about contemporary Western European ideas. And that fell out then. You know, I mean, if I'm really honest about this, I think it's very difficult to see the anything big American. I think that obviously the way people speak is American. That's one thing. So any transference from the linguistic side to the page will be specific, you see, in particular, right? You've got that you can talk from. In the same way that, you know, that the American movies are extremely difficult. I don't know if you went to the cinema and you hear American movies, and it's very difficult to tune in sometimes to the language, for me anyway. You know what I mean? You have to like concentrate. And it's the same for Americans listening to the English film. Exactly the same. Again and again, I'm told that they can't understand the English soundtrack. And it's a question of like tuning in to the sound range, you know, going on here. So insofar as that's transferred to the page, you've got that. And clearly, the we don't have in this country the kind of sense of enormous, large, cultivatable areas that you get in Middle Western novels about farms, like Willa Cather is a typical novelist. These tend to be like second-rate novelists. I don't mean second-rate in the mean sense. I mean not quite that universal greatness level, because they do deal very much with regions which are not repeated elsewhere in the world. But the one thing to say that within Willa Cather's novels about great wheatland species is a specifically American thing. And quite another to say that a Russian novel about, you know, a collective farm with enormous wheatland spaces wouldn't have very similar elements. Do you see what I mean? Because of the nature of the agrarian life in a large spatial area devoted to wheat and the harvesting of it. Do you see what I mean? The kind of life economy, the kind of pattern there. The distances travelled, the non-urbanness of it, will be common factors. Do you see what I mean? So you'd have to leak off somehow what the difference was. I'm telling you this because it may seem terribly obvious, but believe me, the amount of tosh that's written about the specifically Americans in American literature is considerable. You must know that Americans who are around in our group, and I find it very tiresome and very off-putting. So there are these things, really, that there are certain things, but do watch it, that it, don't jump, if you will, please, right at the beginning of our discussion on these things, to looking for the specifically American. My advice to you would be this, enjoy it, first of all, enjoy the stories, And let's consider them as like entities in themselves until we've built like Poe, Hawthorne, Melville, Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman together, like as a 19th century thing. And then do we have things in common between these writers? What does it mean that they were all together roughly between 1830 and the Civil War, you see, in that place? And what does it mean? I don't think I'm giving away secrets. What does it mean that when one major critic, F.O. Matteson, called that period the American Renaissance? It is the first big period. You see, like Poe, Hawthorne, Melville, Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, major writers by any standard, coming together in America at that time. And clearly, there's a kind of development of a literary culture there, which stands for the first power, as it were, the first concrete, point-attable energy in the culture for the first time. Because before that, there is imitation English couplets in the 18th century, imitation metaphysical poetry in the 17th, imitation Puritan sermons, with, here and there, as I said earlier, indications of American locality. I mean, for instance, the tension that a Puritan would feel coming from Europe to escape religious persecution would be the kind of tension of that kind of situation transplanted to a narrow seaboard with wilderness and Indians here, the Atlantic here, and therefore a difficulty of penetrating either way from that settlement seaboard. And clearly that would develop a mentality by the second generation. Do you see what I mean? Of a particular kind, wouldn't it? It would be like a space-time geographic locality which would generate character, attitudes, you see, from quite specific things, like what are we going to grow? And they had to get used to the fact that the climate wasn't, although the vegetation looked similar, the climate was not similar to the English climate or the Dutch climate or whatever it was they'd come from. They'd come one so heavily there. So this kind of thing, immediately a certain kind of tension. But it's very odd, the literature that came out for a long time, the forms of it, the sound of it, sounds more like English literature than anything else. It's, you know, what they write about is more specifically. For instance, one poet, a woman, who was in fact the daughter of a steward of an East Anglian earl's domain, was transported over there when she was young. And she writes sort of 17th century metaphysical stuff, descriptive pastoral stuff. Now and then you feel, although she says Philomel every now and then, you know, she's like, there are no nightingales in America. And Columbus discovered that, by the way, it's in his journals. Like, he's worried, like, you know, no Philomel, where's the myth? And so, like, they had to worry about it. And then she says Philomel because, no, it's just a little bad habit of writing pastoral poetry. But every now and then you think, aha, that plant, or whatever it is, doesn't grow in America. That seems like an American, like in England, that seems like an American sound, you see. And that's not overlap area. But you have to watch it very carefully. And that's about all there is, really. You see what I mean? I mean, one must not push this thing. It's a great mistake to push it, to my mind. Those of you who heard my Melville thing on Monday will realize that I was pushing it quite hard there, because you can, in the middle of the 19th century, say, okay, what are the Americans doing in the Pacific? And that's something else, do you see? That's a specific action of Americans in the Pacific Ocean for economic, imperialistic, and adventurous programs. And you can point to those in that particular way. And you can say, okay, what's the difference between American explorers and the British ones, if there's any at all, and so on. No writer, and this is where we are in luck, and why I'm lecturing on Melville, there's nobody like Melville at all in the history of literature. He is quite individual. Nobody is dealing with that material in that particular way. So we have a uniqueness there. And I do feel that the uniqueness is American, and I'm going to come to that. But I'm not saying there is a uniqueness with American literature. I'm much more happy of saying there are certain uniquenesses in American writers, in particular. You see, because of the experience. You see the difference here. This may sound terribly complicated, but it's very important that you get these ideas at the beginning, you see, so that you mustn't expect yourself. I know in the past students have said to me, like privily, as they say in the 17th century, sidling up, as they say now, saying, I don't see what's American in this. And I suddenly realised I should have said, please don't look for it. And that's what I'm saying to you, really. Like, if don't get worried that you can't see the specific blatant thing you're looking for, which is like some difference you see in that particular way. I really don't think, I think that's frustrating and hampering. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, get on with it, enjoy the stuff, and find out what in fact it means. And then maybe we'll gradually fumble out what the American factors are, if there are. But I think, in actual fact, I may be wrong, but I think you'll find that they're less than maybe you thought, maybe I thought once, and as a whole, over a general thing, but in specific cases, the non-duplicatability of the sensibility of Poe, Hawthorne, Melville, Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman is absolutely explicit. You cannot compare any. I mean, Whitman's contemporaries were Baudelaire and Tennyson. And if you can make a comparison between those three, I'll eat my hat, that's all. Because you just can't. And that is bad. You see? I mean, that man is really explicitly himself. Emerson is a difficult case because he read Wordsworth, and he read Coleridge, and he met them, and he read Carlyle. And I don't want to fox you around about this one, but you'll see when you read Emerson that some of it will sound very familiar. You know, it would sound like early 19th century English Romanticism. And yet, he is in many ways specifically of the Connecticut in his attitudes. So the little cases like this you have to watch, do you think? And that kind of Emerson is a pretty tricky case, actually. Mark Twain, I don't think he's duplicatable at all by anything in Europe. But the idea to find out from Poe, Hawthorne, Melville, Emerson, Thoreau, that crowd, common American factors is a bit beyond me. I don't really see it at the moment too clearly. You know, when I began studying American literature, I picked up what other people had told me, to be honest, and thought, yeah, that's American, that's off space. And now I don't see it. I just don't. And I'm finding it very difficult to justify, the theories that I once held. So that's it. The other thing I want to say to you is that's the big first period. In term one there, Mark Twain is a little bit outside this, but term one represents that first big climax. Now, the writers, Mark Twain, Emily Dickinson, Stephen Crane, Theodore Dreiser, represent the next big florescence of American literature. And that is that Mark Twain wrote during the Civil War, but let's just take it as being post-Civil War. Now, it really is a gap. The effect of you must understand, when you start reading these people, that the Civil War was the great upheaval in America from which America has not recovered yet. I mean it quite seriously. That is, once and for all, the anticipated benefits of union, of the unification in economics, government, national feeling, everything that was anticipated from the time of Washington, was finally broken, fundamentally broken, and the tensions between North and South are still there, as you all know. I never said that. Now, it really is a watershed, you see, in that particular way. So, when we come to that break, I'll have to say something to you and discuss with you about the Civil War, you see, and what it means. But it is a break. And the break is not just due to those tensions, it's that during the Civil War, railways developed in America. That does begin to unite the country, ironically, for the first time, at the very time it's breaking up, from the old pattern, you see, and the railways start. And what's more, in the 1860s and 70s, the size of big cities developed. New York, Chicago, you see, they start being something like the New York, Chicago we know now, these skyscrapers and big buildings and so on, and a kind of density. And then you start getting a city literature for the first time in America. Do you see? It's a real watershed, that Civil War time. Then you get city works. Dreiser's American Tragedy is a major
what I call a major city, Western city novel. It's very urban. The anticipations of the characters are within a non-agrarian area, and you get the feeling of the pressure of other people on them in a density, a city density. Do you see? That kind of thing you want to look for. Stephen Crane's novel is a Civil War novel. So there's that break. Then, of course, there is the next division. I'm trying to help you, like, across the literature in all time. The next division is of course, the 20s. And like into war period, let's call it. And then, so one looks at O'Neill, Odets, Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Lewis, and Dos Passos together to represent like 20s, 30s figures. I put Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams in because I want to talk about the drama there, but strictly speaking, they shouldn't be there at all if we're going to do this chronology thing. And then there are writers one associates more with the 30s and 40s, like Crane, Faulkner, and Thomas Wolfe, and Ezra Pound, and William Carlos Williams. So there's a bit more like rhyme and reason in this down list than meets the eye, you see. It's fairly carefully done to suggest that it would be helpful if one could think of that mid-19th century group, you see, then the Civil War and post-Civil War group, and then the 20s crowd, and then the people associated with the 30s and 40s. Way, you see. I mean, it won't like sprawl out. Okay? That's the way to do it. Okay, I'm sorry we have to curtail it. I'm late already. And I'm sorry about the shambles, but you know how.